This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have with us a very distinguished guest, Dr. Paula Richmond. She is William H. Danforth Professor of South Asian Religions Emerita at Oberlin College. She has edited 3 volumes and published more than 30 articles on the diversity of the Indian Ramayana tradition. We'll be speaking today about a book, brand new OUP book, hot off the presses, that she's co-edited, called Performing the Ramayana Tradition, Enactments, Interpretations, and Arguments. Paula, a hearty welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me with you.
You had said something interesting about the podcast medium right before we got started, and perhaps we can say a bit more about that for our audience, especially in this day and age.
This book, Performing the Ramayana Tradition, we submitted the final copy in January before the coronavirus hit the US. But after that, the publication process was very, very extended. And I've heard from other people and other presses that it was a terrible time for publishers. And there was a backup, there's deadlines that were missed, and also financially, academic presses are having a hard time. So I think it really is crucial and very helpful to the field as a whole to have podcasts like this from books, for books that are just coming out, because people need to know about books in order to keep up with what's going on in the field. So thank you for your work.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor to have you on here. And it's really gratifying that our colleagues, including yourself, see the real value of this. I think etymologically of publish, public, publicize, you know, the podcast is sort of a parallel means of publication. And who knows, I'll be really frank with you and anyone listening. I had no clue that so niche, so nerdy a podcast could possibly be so popular and or integrated with the lives of academics and their courses. It's slightly staggering and a bit of an out-of-body experience as I speak into a black box in the corner of Midtown Toronto. But hey, I'm glad it's working for you guys. Now I've said too much. More about your book. Actually, before your book, your co-edited book, tell us about this love affair with the Ramayana. Like, clearly, I mean, you're passionate about it. You're prolific on the topic. How did this start up for you? What really caught your interest?
Well, I think part of it was the time that I began teaching. Like the first decade I began teaching, it was a time when people were rethinking the whole notion of a canonical text and pushing boundaries in fields like literature. And one of the things that I found fascinating was that the more I looked into the Ramayana tradition, the more I saw how many voices were involved in different parts of India, different languages and different literary traditions, and how, in a sense, that tradition was so all-encompassing that it was, in a way, a kind of a model for how a narrative tradition could be one that could mean different things to different people at different times in different communities.
Yeah, it's a captivating text. At the right time, I happened to do a senior undergrad course on the Valmiki Ramayana in my senior year. And then it just gripped me. I was just fascinated by this Rama being celebrated for, you know, abandoning his kingdom in a time of need and causing so much suffering. There was something that I need to figure out. So the Ramayana actually ended up seducing me into a master's at the University of Toronto. I finished in 2010, I believe. So it's alluring, it's gripping narrative, and sort of I live in the world of Sanskrit narrative, but far more than narrative. Your book obviously shows this, and we'll dive into the specifics, but far more than narrative, the Ramayana really seeps into every aspect of Indic culture, doesn't it?
Yes. It's in proverbs, it's in jokes, it's in allusions. You'd be so amazed to see where it turns up if you are observant.
Mm-hmm. How did this project on performance traditions arise?
Well, basically, in 2011, I was invited to attend the third Ramayana Festival at the Adi Shakti Laboratory for Theatre Arts and Research. That's in Puducherry, or also known as Pondicherry. And I was delighted when I saw the lineup of performances. For a person like me, it was like suddenly being reborn in paradise, because there were troupes from all over India, you know, all the way from Assam to Kerala. And they were all, ones that I'd read about, but never actually seen in performance. So I readily accepted the invitation, and I was not disappointed. Now, the thing that made this notion of collaborating exciting for me was that I was much more involved with the textual tradition, although I had begun to study certain plays that were intriguing to me. And the co-director of the festival was Professor Rustam Barucha, who was at that time teaching at JNU, Nehru University in Delhi, in performance studies and theater. I wanted to find out how he responded to this material. And he wanted to find out why I was so intrigued by little changes in plot or different ways of turning stories, moving incidents around, and suddenly they came out differently. So we really were not just two people collaborating. We made a connection between two academic disciplines of training. And that was fairly exciting. And our idea was to, and this came after the three Ramayana festivals. This was the final festival. We sat down and we thought about which people in various different regional traditions we'd like to have write essays for a volume, which provided voices from within the performing traditions about how they viewed the epic and the things that were interesting to them, which meant that we were basically delving into multiple case studies of different kinds of performance traditions. In India, each performance tradition has its own history, its own sort of lineage of ways of understanding the text. And we wanted to hear about those things and how they shaped not only what people thought about the text, but what choices they made in commissioning performances, enacting performances, and responding to performances.
Fascinating. Could you say a bit more about your experience of the cross-pollination of disciplines?
Yeah, I think when I first began, I was very interested in a written text and the way that it was performed, because that was my training. But over time, there were things that I noticed about, say, seeing the same performance by the same group, but two or three times, the ways things changed in different nights of the performance. I was intrigued At this festival, there was a performance every night. And the following morning, the whole troupe would be there at the theater, and there would be a discussion with questions from the audience. What an unusual opportunity. If you just go to a performance, you don't usually have the following day to like bring all your doubts and questions and why did you do it this way? And it was so rich. I could just see that this was going to be something that lots of people would be interested in. And the cross-pollination was not just performance studies and religion, but it was performance studies, religion, and performers of all types. It was rich.
Rich indeed. I ended up stumbling across a professor of defense studies at the Canadian College of the Armed Forces during my master's on the Valmiki Ramayana, and we were having this friendly but lively debate on the ethics of violence, ahimsa versus justified force. And we ended up, a core part of my master's thesis was this lens of just war theory in the Valmiki Ramayana. It never would have occurred to me without the interaction. So it's always great when folks from very different disciplines, religious studies, performative studies, philology, whatever, they can come together and enrich our understanding of these works, particularly in that works such as the Ramayana are just so rich to begin with. They lend themselves to so many different kinds of interpretation.
Absolutely.
Do you want to say a quick word about the structure of the book, the sections sure. that the papers are structured in?
Sure, I'll be happy to do that. The very beginning, there are actually there are six sections. The very beginning has an essay that I wrote called Narrative Resources for Performing the Ramayana Tradition. Basically, I'm saying, you know, these are the texts that the case studies in this edited volume draw upon. Then Rustam Barucha has written the next one, Thinking the Ramayana Tradition Through Performance. You really get a sense of where he's coming from. And then the third is a translation of a very condensed account of the Ramayana, which is taught to students of Kudyatam as a way of learning the hand gestures that they use in their dance. So you're getting the performer's experience of the text there. And it was a very interesting way to start out. There are basically three beginnings, three different ways of looking at the text. Then the next section is Politics of Caste. It has several, there are three pieces in there about Shambhuka, who is the Shudra, who's beheaded by Rama because he's breaking the rule that only the twice-borns can perform asceticism. And this is a very old part of the text. It comes from Valmiki, the last book of Valmiki. Nobody knows for sure, but most people think that that was a slightly later interpolation. Aaron Sheridan looks at the different modern retellings of the Shambhuka story as a play. It's almost like it's been rediscovered in recent years because it's been reinterpreted in the development of Dalit literary issues. And then the last one is by a director talks about how they came up with their particular story of Shambhuka's killing and brought in all kinds of other materials. And so you see a kind of a way in which even a small episode, something really short, can then become something that is much grander or much more expansive than you would have imagined. And I think that that's true of many, many incidents in the Ramayana that become entire performance traditions in themselves. The next session called the Interrogating the Antihero, that really is sort of the core of what Rustam and I were doing, because we were both studying performances that featured Ravana. And the ones that I was looking at were from South India. And they really were drawn to texts that were reinterpreting Ravana's life. In one of the plays that I looked at, it shows how Ravana was actually from a very marginalized background. And his mother was so, she was so sad that her son was the son of a second wife and therefore would have no opportunity to succeed in life. And yet the half-brother by the first wife was getting all of the money and the prestige, and he became the god of wealth. And it's a very intriguing story from the way it was reinterpreted. This was in 1780, where Ravana became a sort of a underdog who was working to gain social mobility in society through asceticism and became the ruler of the three worlds. I've heard of social mobility, but that is an extraordinary kind of social mobility.
Oh, that's moving on way up.
Right, yeah, all the way. And then Rustam Barucha was looking at very modern, very avant-garde views of Ravana. This one I just think is fascinating. It's told from the perspective of the 10th head of Ravana. The 10th head feels marginalized because all the 9 heads have a different, very, very rigid notion of what one should do. And the 10th head wants to be a dissident, and he wants to do things that are different from what conformists do. So, I mean, you see everything coming into this story. The next section is called Performing Gender. This is a part of the book that's really fascinating. There's essays by a woman who played Rama for, I think she said 26 years, and how her view of Rama changed over those 26 years as different kinds of events happened in society. And it just is a very, it's how her life and her training interacted with what was going on in the outside society in a period when there was a lot of change going on in India. And there's an essay there about a performance tradition in Tamil Nadu, Kattaikutta, which has been traditionally all male, but she was working at a school for children in which all of the parts in a play about the Ramayana ended up going to women. And what that did in terms of the way people perceive the performance. And then a third one about the amazing dancer, Usha Nangiar. This was written by M.V. Narayanan, who's an expert on Kudiyattam and Nangiar, the woman's solo performance tradition, about how she went back into the performance texts and acting manuals and discovered that long, long ago, the Kudiyattam tradition had women performing in the plays, and also the women would perform small solos that told the lives of the women that were acting in the, not the, the women, the characters that were in that play. So, for example, she actually revived performances that hadn't been performed in over 100 years. And so I think that Performing Gender is really an example of a place where we found a wide variety of reinterpretations of the epic going on. The next section is called Interviews and Arguments. It reminds me a little bit of this podcast, because it's mostly us talking to various different people about their experiences in enacting certain episodes from the play. And my favorite essay is the last one in that section called Performing the Argument. Imagine this. Imagine that you live in Karnataka and that you are deeply immersed in the tradition of narrative and Puranic storytelling. This particular form of performance called Talamadale is actually a form of debate in which two people are assigned characters from the play, and they have to debate with each other and try and prove each other wrong. And what's fascinating about this format, and you could see that this was very much it was a form of verbal art. They come to the venue, and only when they arrive at the place where they're going to perform are they told which episode from the Ramayana they will be dealing with and which role they're assigned to play. And then they have to argue with each other. They have to debate. They have to refer to all kinds of, you know, famous quotes, other great thinkers. And one night, there's a case of one man who was so well-trained that one night he played Ravana, and everybody said, oh my God, Ravana is the real hero of this story. The next night he played Rama, and that night everyone said, oh my God, Rama is the only one who's really understanding the nature of reality. So I just had never come across anything like that. And it's really an amazing performance tradition. And then the last one is more about everyday life and performance. One of the essays in that talks mainly about everybody. Well, there's so many people who have studied the Ramlila of Ramnagar. It's probably one of the most famous performances in the world. But he decided to look at it from a new perspective. Most people look at how do the performers perform the episodes. But what he asked was, what's happening when there aren't performances going on? They're waiting for the next scene, they're moving to the next place, or they have to be there for an early morning performance, so they stay at the site all night and, you know, cook, eat dinner, listen to, you know, music, stuff like that. What is the other part of the Ramlila, the one that you never heard about until now, if you didn't attend? And then some reflections on the Ramayana by Rustam Barucha at the end. So I want to make it clear that this is not a book that makes any universal claims about all performance traditions. We picked some performance traditions that struck us as very, very, very developed and very intriguing in terms of what things they did and didn't do. And we're suggesting that the people who read this book now go out and attend other performances and see what they can discover. So that's it.
Fascinating. You did a great job, actually, of touching on all of the sections and telling a story throughout. So many directions to take this in. Okay, so speaking of the readers of this book, yes. Who do you think might most like to read this or might most benefit from this? What sorts of readers, audiences?
Okay, well, you know the regular, the usual suspects, the South Asian scholars, scholars of Indian religions, and scholars of epics. But what is interesting to me is that there are some audiences that I really hadn't thought very much about as readers, and they are performers. I've had people who want to know. Let me give some examples. I've had a dancer who called me up and said, I want to know how I can do a Ramayana performance that takes into account more than just the usual interpretations of the story. And if you go to this book, there's one entire essay that's written by a dancer that tells you how she was trained and then what happened afterwards when she thought about Rama in different ways. I think people, feminist scholars, would find this a pretty interesting set of essays to look at, because so many of the things that deal with gender that in, say, Valmiki are cut and dry, here are being questioned, are being rethought, are being reconceptualized even. I think one of the things that I found intriguing about the essays was that there's a lot more attention to music in performance. Music in performance is not a topic that has been well researched, in the sense that music can have such an effect in a performance. It can set a mood. It can actually, in some cases, it fills in the story. I'm thinking about, again, this fascinating Palamadele tradition of debate. The only thing that people have that's set before they start is, there is, for every one of these episodes that's performed and debated, there's a set of songs that have been written. The vocalist goes to the set, and again, he doesn't know what play it is until he gets to the site. He thinks through the set of songs that are dealing with this episode, and he is the one who chooses the ones that he's going to sing for this performance. And then the players, they have to, once the song is over, there's lots of songs, it goes song, dialogue. Once the song is over, the performers have to pick something, either a theme or a word or a phrase from the song, and use it as a start of a debate. So they have to choose from the song. And so this is a performance where I would say there's three people, or three kinds of people, making choices. The patron makes a choice, each of the actors makes a choice, and the musician makes a choice. So that is a very collaborative form of performance. So there's another reader. This is one of my all-time favorite kinds of readers. I call it the smart non-specialist who enjoys encountering new fields of thought. And
a lifelong learner.
Lifelong learners. That was what I loved about my experience being a teacher at Oberlin. I would have these people who were math majors, and in their last semester, they would take a course on Indian religions. They asked such interesting questions, you know, questions that weren't raised by anybody in the field. So I wrote the part of the book that I wrote. I wrote it so that I gave enough background so that my students could understand it and be interested in it. So I hope many people read it.
Oh, that's great. That's a really rich and thoughtful response. One of the areas that I've worked in is continuing studies. I was at continuing studies at the University of Toronto. 2010 to about 2018, officially 2020. Uh-huh. And similarly, you'd have folks who have some knowledge in the particular subject area. For me, it was comparative religion that I taught there. And sometimes folks who were coming from a completely different discipline, but always wanted to know something about religion or Hinduism or whatever it was. And those out of the box questions,
fascinating.
They're like, yes, because they force you to see it anew, right? They force you to just land here from Mars and remove your helmet and be like, what is this that's happening here? Yes, indeed. Certainly the implications of each contribution of each paper They're varied and they're vast, pertaining to caste and gender and performance issues and all that. What would you say some perhaps broad themes are, otherwise put, what would you say is the general takeaways or sort of contribution to scholarship? How would you talk about the volume as a whole?
You know, that's a very hard question in an edited volume, because it's sort of more than the sum of its parts. Let me try to answer that question by just giving a few observations. By no means is this is this the only way to look at it, but I guess I'd like to start by saying that there's a difference between a bunch of papers that are published in the same book and a set of essays that focus on different aspects of the same issues. And so in some ways, any way you read two different essays in this book, it'll be interesting to see how the themes and the issues are in some way connected or interlinked. That's just to say that I can't tell you everything, but I'll just give you a few examples. One of the things that I found really interesting after reading different texts of the Ramayana and the texts like Valmiki, Kamban, Tulsidas, those texts have a beginning and a middle and an end. They have a narrative arc and you can follow it. And it's very rarely that a performance tradition has the equivalent. The one exception I can think of right off the bat to that is the Ram Lila of Ramnagar, Banaras. And the reason for that is because that particular tradition of Ram Lila is a month long and every verse in Tulsidas is recited from the beginning to the end. Now, it's important to keep in mind, because otherwise that would sound absolutely overwhelming, is that people come to certain nights and not others. In the very beginning of the text, when there's a lot of stuff that's not particularly dramatic, the audiences are very small. But on certain nights, thousands of people are attending. And that, even though it has a beginning and a middle and an end, certain nights are the nights that thousands of people attend. Every year, certain nights are really popular nights. So that suggests that in performance, it's not so much the whole narrative arc, it's people picking episodes and thinking about and enacting those episodes. Almost all of the essays deal with a few episodes that are crucial to those performances. For example, there were several plays that were dealing with something, an episode that's generally known as Sita Svayamvara, the breaking of the bow or the marrying of Sita. And then there are other episodes where you just never see them performed. And what accounts for that? Some of the essays talk about why certain episodes seem so important to them. And so that's one thing, that it is much more of an episodic endeavor than I would have imagined beforehand.
The image of sampling from a buffet comes to mind rather than sort of a seven-course meal.
Yeah, you can't eat everything. So you sample. And certain items on any buffet are going to be more popular than others.
to be savored, no doubt.
Exactly. And that really fits, that image fits. I would even add something else. The people who come to that buffet are foodies, and they really come to see what is going to be tasted that night. How can people do it in an especially wonderful way? So a Okay, what other things? I would say that the theatrical tradition determines a lot more about the play or the drama than I would have suspected beforehand. And I'll give you an example. Bhavabhuti has a play called Uttara Ramacharita, which is about the later days of Rama. Now, it's in a form of Sanskrit drama where there has to be a happy ending. Now, generally, in many Ramayanas, there is not a happy ending because Sita is banished to the forest and she raises her sons, and then later on, she goes back to her mother. But since there can't be an unhappy ending, in that play, Rama and Sita are reconciled and back in love at the end. It's the effect of the conventions of that particular kind of genre. Another example is in the Uday Shankar India Culture Center performances, it is not the case that most of the performers are men, or all of the performers are men. In other kinds of performances in India, it's only been men who were in troops, traveling troops that moved around and performed. And those troops had men who were specialists in performing the roles of women. But this more modern dance style of Uday Shankar, they taught two different kinds of movements to all of the students. First, they taught the male movements, which were based on Kathakali, and then to all of the students, they taught Manipuri styles, Bharatanatyam and Kathak, which were female movements. Now, if you played the role of Rama, it didn't matter if you were not a man. It only mattered if you knew the masculine movements that were the basis of that tradition. So again, I think I learned a lot more about how a particular tradition of theater can shape what you see of the Ramayana. And then I just like to say one other thing that I noticed, which is there's an awful lot of emphasis in the transmission of a theatrical tradition on the guru who passes down the particular way that those performers perform. It's not some independent genius who comes out of nowhere and says, I have a totally new way to perform the Ramayana. That's more
parampara.
Yes, exactly. The parampara. And some of those people are like, if you sit around with a bunch of performers and you ask them, what effect did Amanur Madhava Chakyar have on your performance? You could be there for 2 hours. They would recall for you conversations that they had with him and how they do their performance today, even though it's been years since that person was alive.
So fascinating. Thank you for indulging my question, because on the one hand, of course, this is a book about the Ramayana, performing the Ramayana. On the other hand, it's a book that shows the utter diversity of that.
Yes.
And it's there is both a centrifugal and centripetal thrust to the book, because what you're trying to show is the utter diversity of performances of whatever this thing called the Ramayana is. But I'm very glad that you indulged the question, because you're able to broad strokes paint for the listeners some of the themes, some of what can be learned or discerned or noted, and of course the various readers will note other things and pay attention to other things. But that's quite useful to have those broad strokes comments. And one of the things I find myself saying more and more, whether I'm teaching at the OCHS or at the online school, is that there'll be questions about mantras, and everything that I answer, I'll say, this is provisional. This is everything, this is the case, but yes, this is a daytime, yes. this is a daytime mantra, but at Krishna Paksha, in this lineage, you chant it at night for some other aim, But one of the ideas I keep returning to is what I'm about to say is generative, not exhaustive. And that gets them out of the mindset of, okay, I have the rule now. No. I'm pointing to a pattern, right? You can, it's moving in the opposite direction that critical thinking likes to work, which is, what is it? You know, slice that idea. Where
define
is it?
But it? Tell its limits.
Exactly. Yes. Own it. Exactly. Fantastic. This has obviously been a work that's been long in gestation. You must be ecstatic to have it out in the world. Are you currently working on the Ramayana, or what are next steps for you?
Well, I'm getting kind of old now, so I'm not planning another 10-year project, but I do have a project that I'm pretty excited about that I just finished writing. I've become intrigued by visual representations of episodes in the Ramayana, and I spent a lot of time studying and analyzing a set of Mithila paintings of Sita. Now, before one says, "Well, why that?" Mithila is the place where traditionally Sita was found in a furrow on the ground and raised. So how do men and women painters, actually women and men painters, because more women write paintings, how do they portray Sita? And this is a painting tradition that began in the late 60s and continues today. And one of the things that's very interesting is that the early painters and the painters in the last decade are portraying her in very different ways. And that is so interesting. And now I'd like to look at some other painting traditions.
That's fascinating. I might be slightly biased because the Ramayana has called me as well, but that is absolutely fascinating for a number of reasons. Was there anything about the volume that you hope to touch on before we close?
Let's see. Boy, I should have been prepared for this kind of question.
No.
I think that actually I don't see this volume as actually complete in the sense that when I go back to India, if I hear about a performance, I'm going to be sure I get to it. So I still think there's a lot more to see and to think about.
Well, the best books, as I like to say, are beginnings, not endings, fields of study. So,
yes, I agree. Yeah.
Thank you so much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you for inviting me. And it's been a pleasure to interact with you.
Pleasure was mine. For those of you been listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Paula Richman, co-editor of Performing the Ramayana Tradition, a brand new OUP Press, OUP book. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, keep reading, and go attend a performance of the Ramayana. Take care.